You're listening to Write the Book, the podcast for writers and curious readers, coming to you from Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a new interview with the author Christine Sneed, who you may recall from a 2015 conversation about her novel Paris, He Said. This month, we talked about her new story collection, The Virginity of Famous Men, just out from Bloomsbury, USA. Her earlier books are the prize-winning Portraits of a Few of the People I've Made Cry and Little Known Facts. She has published stories in Best American Short Stories, the Penn O. Henry Prize Stories, New England Review, Plowshares, Glimmer Train, and many others. Also a poet, Christine Sneed has received an Illinois Arts Council Fellowship in Poetry and was the recipient of the 2013 21st Century Award from the Chicago Public Library Foundation. If I read all of her accolades, we would never get to the interview, so I'll just leave it there. She lives in Evanston, Illinois, and teaches creative writing for the MFA programs at Northwestern University and at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's also just starting on the fiction faculty of the Regis University Low Residency MFA program. The Virginity of Famous Men is a deeply perceptive collection on the human condition, featuring protagonists attempting to make peace with their choices, both personal and professional. Long intrigued by love and loneliness, Sneed leads readers through emotional landscapes both familiar and uncharted. These probing stories are explorations of the compassionate and passionate impulses that are inherent in, and often the source of, both abiding joy and serious distress in every human life. When I spoke with Christine Sneed, I began by asking how this collection came into being.
When I'm working on a longer project, if I'm writing a novel, I'm often working on a short story in between, bouts with the novel, because a novel just... I mean, some people really prefer writing novels to writing short stories, but I love writing short stories, and some of it is just because the form is more forgiving. You don't spend, 5 years writing a short story usually.
Right.
So I was working on stories in tandem with a couple of different novel manuscripts, and probably, I think actually these stories, some of them are as old as maybe 9 years.
Okay.
And the most recent one is actually the title story, which I wrote last fall. So okay. About a year ago, I was working on that title story and The Virginity of Famous Men. And the others range, as I mentioned, from probably about 9 years ago until last year.
Yeah. And so when you were working on that title story, did you already have like the contract with your publisher and you were trying to finish it for the collection and they were waiting for it, that sort of thing?
Basically, yes. This collection sold with Paris, He Said, back in July 2013,
so
3 years ago. And then it was pretty much intact, except when I sent the draft initially to my editor, Nancy Miller, at Bloomsbury, there were 14 stories in it. And then, there were probably a little more than we needed. This is actually kind of a long book. It's just as many words as my novel, so it's about 92,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of writers, their story collections are maybe 200 pages. Sometimes there's longer ones, certainly. But I had the good fortune of having quite a few short stories to choose from when I ultimately put this manuscript together. And then I worked with my editor. We cut out a couple stories and then added two other ones. And then we might have cut three and then I added two more, including the title story. So we just worked on that draft, that final draft this past year. And, I feel like I'm very happy with the contents and the way that everything came together, but I don't know, maybe that's something we could talk about later, but I always worry that, one thing that I saw with some of the early reviews is one reader said, oh, these stories are not all linked, and I like linked collections.
Oh.
And I actually prefer non-linked collections of short stories. I love, novel cycles or story cycles, which are, linked collections with the same characters over and over, but like Olive Kitteridge is a little bit like that.
Yes.
And but I was really thinking more thematically when I put this collection together.
Well, I think it holds together really well thematically, and I really enjoyed it. I feel like it's definitely a collection that is about relationships, and it's about people trying to make their way through, you know, difficult times, although not necessarily earth-shakingly difficult, more sort of just the human condition. But I really,
yeah.
I totally think that that works as a theme to hold it together, and I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
The very first story in the collection was Beach Vacation, and it's about a mother and son, and I have sons, and as I was reading this, I just was getting so mad. This kid. Isn't that funny? But it just struck me as the perfect subject for conflict in a story is a mother and a son at of a certain age. So I wonder if we can just talk a little bit about the genesis of that story.
Sure. That's one of the stories, actually, that was inspired by two people that I observed. I belong to a gym in Evanston that I go to frequently, and probably, I think I wrote this story 6 or 7 years ago, maybe even 8 years ago. It's been a while. But there was this woman who was probably in her 40s, who had, maybe in her late 40s, she had a son who was, I think, in his early to mid-20s. And he was incredibly good-looking. And everyone in the spinning class, when they walked in, I'm sure they were all just staring at her son and kind of in awe. I mean, he looked like a model. He was really, really beautiful.
Yeah.
And I thought, what would it be like if you're her, you know, his mother, and you're constantly trying to ignore other people, men or women, you know, ogling your child? So I wanted to write about that. And in fact, when I started writing that story, I thought, oh, this is going to be a happy story. But then I recast the age of the son is, you know, he's a teenager finishing high school, and it just ended up being a very different story tonally than I thought it would be. I thought it might just be more that the son would be a nicer person than mm-hmm. he ended up being in this version of the story. So it just was triggered by the sight of this young man and his mother, and then it just became something else. But I just realized, you know, especially with the way that a lot of middle-class families have child-centered homes now, with children being, I guess one friend of my partner's said, little emperors.
Yes.
My partner Adam and I don't have kids. And I've just noticed, too, just like from teaching college-level writing classes, that, you know, some kids are very confident and they feel like they deserve things that maybe they don't deserve. And so I was just interested in thinking about how a child becomes pretty unbearable.
Yes.
And, you know, the parents feeling like they are to blame in part for that. And some parents probably don't, but this character, Jan, the mother, definitely does feel like she and her husband didn't do the job that they should have with their child.
Right.
And teaching him to be more respectful.
It's interesting that you say that about the little emperors, because one thing I've noticed lately is that young women are more confident than I think my generation of women was. And mm-hmm. so I actually sort of enjoy the confidence of some of the young women I meet today. And just I'm so happy that they are able to kind of be themselves and stand up and say what they're thinking. On the other hand, there's a lot of entitlement there as well. So it's a fine line, you know, of becoming a graceful person
yeah.
who has her own opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really good to have confidence, but I also think you have to have humility.
Mm-hmm.
And finding the balance between confidence and humility it's hard to do that. So that's really something that I write about and think about a lot, and I talk about it a lot with friends.
Yeah.
Just because I think there's not enough humility anymore. And the way, you know, there's so much discussion about social media creating a lot of narcissism. And definitely there has to be something to that. I've noticed it too, just like why am I looking at my Facebook page? Why am I looking at Twitter all the time? So that you really have to fight against that. And just it's not all about you all the time.
I think it's particularly hard to fight that when you have a new book out, too, because I think there's this sense that, you know, okay, it just came out, people are looking at it, what are they saying, you know, and I you know, when my book, I only had one so far, but when it came out, I just remember checking Facebook all the time and checking to see, like, who loves me now,
yeah.
You know, it's just this horrible
yes.
enabler of self-satisfaction.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, I think just having a smartphone is a terrible thing, too. I mean, it's really nice to have it when you're driving and you're lost or you don't want to get lost. But, yeah, I mean, I have a relationship with my phone that is unlike any other relationship that I have. So it's very codependent. Or maybe it's just me being dependent on my phone. My phone doesn't care about me, but it's, you know,
it's
a symbol for everything, everything in your life.
That's funny. Now, more than one story in this collection concerns famous people, famous men, and relationships. And it made me wonder if you have experience with famous people.
Well, I do sort of tangentially. I have family that work in Hollywood, and they know a number of very well-known people and are friends with some of them. And but even before, this is my partner Adam's sister and her husband. They live in LA and they work in the industry. And so, but even before I knew Adam, you know, I guess when I started writing the stories about 9 years ago, I've been with Adam for about 6.5 years. I was very interested in jealousy as a theme, and just also how jealousy is so difficult for people to face, and it's most, you know, embodied by just the, you know, the force behind jealousy is embodied by wealth and beauty and, you know, just celebrity in general. We admire people who are famous, but we're also on some level extremely jealous of the lives that we believe they lead. And I have just wanted to examine that. And so with these stories, and then also my second book, Little Known Facts, I wrote about, you know, what I saw as kind of the reality of being famous and being close to someone famous. It's just, you can't ever, you basically never can take anything for granted. Mm-hmm. You're probably not that important. Fame is really the most important thing to the famous, at least as I can see it, even though they might not want it to be. But it makes it hard to have relationships that are not informed in some way about the celebrity's presence as a, you know, a public figure.
Right.
So that to me is just a very, I guess I'm really inspired by that subject.
Yeah. I heard this interview with Meryl Streep recently. She was on Fresh Air, and she was talking about being Meryl Streep, and she was referring to Meryl Streep not as herself, but as this thing that she had become. And it was really kind of heartbreaking to hear her put it in those terms, and it made me really understand, or start to understand, mm-hmm. a little bit how hard that must be, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's really, I mean, we see the trappings and we see the facade. Like, I used to think that Hollywood was like the Oscars, you know, that every day was like the Oscars in Hollywood.
Right.
In fact, that's just like a few hours once a year, and all the ego and all the jockeying behind the scenes and the disappointments and frustrations and rivalries, those are all there, but they're not, that's not the focus. It's all there. And so I just really want to think about, you know, why we need everything to be so beautiful, when in fact the reality is that it's probably extremely difficult and hard on people, as you said. Like, I mean, yes, Meryl Streep's very famous and successful and wealthy, but even those things don't mean that you're going to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm sure she has very good days, but also days that are not so good, because
yeah.
it's just part of being a human.
Right, right. So let's talk about one of the stories that has a famous person in it. It's, there's one early in the collection called The First Wife, and it's a woman who has been married to a very famous man, and it's her story. It was a great story. And there's actually, I was going to ask you about a certain line from the story. The narrator mentions a filmmaker's and writer's trick, and that is to seduce us with the details of a marvelous and improbable coupling, while hinting darkly that things did not end well, that some tragedy or tragic character flaw in one or both of the principals brought on a heartbreaking collapse. And when the collapse comes, it is seldom given more than a few pages, a few sodden minutes at the end. And that comes in the story at a point where the narrator of this story is going to tell you something about what eventually happens, rather than hold it out for the end. And I liked that line, and I liked thinking about that, and I wondered if you think that really is a filmmaking and writing trick that you've noticed.
You know, I do, because I think narrative, you know, linear narratives always begin with, you know, the beginning, and then you have the middle, and then the end, and they progress in that logical way. But there are, you know, a number of novels and films that begin with the end, and then they take you back through a series of flashbacks. Or sometimes they begin with the middle, and then there's this crime that occurs, for example, and then you get up to the point where the crime is committed, and then the aftermath is like the second part of the film. So, you know, I was thinking about it in terms of a love story.
Right.
And I can't think of any off the top of my head, but I know there are films where you see the, like Sophie's Choice, for example, you see Sophie at the beginning, another Meryl Streep movie, but right. You see her at the beginning in New York, and you go then into the past, and you see that, that what her choice was, that, you know, of course, had to do with her children and,
right.
and the Holocaust. So I like the idea of subverting traditional narratives. And so, but I think, too, like the character who's the narrator for The First Wife is knows that the love story is what people want. They don't want the collapse. But in
yes.
fact, what's been most, you know, affecting for her has been the fact that this marriage to this famous man did not work out.
Right. Yeah, it what you're saying and that line, it reminds me of the Aristotelian check mark, the upside down check mark of story narrative, where it starts, you know, in one place, and then it rises and rises and rises and rises to eventually like the climax of the book, and then there's this little tiny fall off at the end, and that little tiny fall off seems like, you know, the few pages that you get, the few sodden minutes at the end to kind of pull everything together.
Yeah. It's just not as much fun as the ride, you know. You don't want the crash. You want the ride.
Right.
So,
yes.
But, of course, what character is often formed by is the crash and the disappointment and the aftermath. So that is, you know, what I really like to think about that when I'm working on a story.
Yeah. Now, you have a story in the collection called Words That Once Shocked Us. I loved that this story is just about really regular people in a fairly unexceptional setting. You know, it's a very simple setting. They work for a company called Clean and Soft, and they take phone calls, and that's their job. And then they eat junk food, and it's just regular people's lives and troubles. How did you come to write that one?
You know, I don't remember what the triggering moment was. I think I was thinking about call centers and
yeah.
just the fact that you have to deal with a lot of strangers, you know, calling you with crazy requests, probably in some cases, and then also just the drudgery of being in an office setting like that, where your phone is ringing and you're waiting for the phone to ring, or you're dreading that it's going to ring. And so I've worked in a number of different offices, and you know, there's a reason why Dilbert is so successful. Just that it's an easy thing to satirize, but it's also such a big part of most people's lives. They have regular 9-to-5 jobs.
Right.
So I just was thinking about, you know, these two women who probably they both wish they were doing something else, but, or at least the narrator, Marcy, does, and the boredom that they're trying to fend off, and you know, that of course leads to trouble. So I think it was just the idea of the call center itself is something that I would never want to work in, you know, especially a sales call center. It would be a nightmare. I'm like, if you want to torture me, put me in a call center. That would be a good way to torture me.
Well, and it's interesting too, you know, every single product, I don't know if this is federally mandated, but just about every product has a little 800 number on the back if you have questions, certainly products that have to do with health or hygiene. And mm-hmm. I've never really thought about who's answering those calls, but that's who Marcy is answering those calls.
Yeah.
That's who's answering them.
And she's actually, you know, underemployed. She should be an accountant and have a better job. And
right.
of course, the market was, you know, not great. So she's underemployed because of that.
And there's this part in the story. I was going to ask you to read this part. It's got to do with the life that she envisions herself having, and maybe she will actually get there. So I wonder if you could maybe read that part, and then we can talk
sure.
about it.
Sure. Okay. They live about 2 miles from me in a brick apartment complex with a dozen units. And here, Marcy's talking about Rachel and her husband, and Rachel and Marcy work together in the call center, and Marcy's going over there to have dinner. Theirs is on the second floor, and when Rachel buzzes me in, the first thing I notice in the hallway is the overwhelming smell of buttered popcorn. My stomach leaps, always hopeful, and I know then, salad or no, that I'm going to eat everything they put in front of me, in seconds, too. I feel more defiance than dread, even as I notice my thighs chafing against the seams of my jeans. Still, I could probably run a marathon, too. I could be like Ben and start training and burn down the fat cells my body doggedly persists in carrying from one day to the next. And maybe I will. Maybe if I change my routines and the way I look, my life will be better. I will find a new job and a nicer man than Tim, one who will not stop for pizza on his way home from work when he knows that I'm making us something special for dinner. One who will not sleep with his much younger coworker and leave me for her before leaving her for one of her even more dim-witted friends. Maybe I will run and run, and it will clear my mind of all the self-doubt and angry grudges and petty fears, and I will become a better judge of character and also find the guts to tell the crank callers just where to stick it.
Great. Thank you for reading that. It's funny. I read this. I had two things happen. First, I read this, and then secondly, I was having a conversation with my nephew who did some telemarketing this summer. He was doing surveys, and he was talking about the people, you know, who are nice versus the people who are mean. And I was, now I'm answering the phone much differently for surveys. I'm trying really hard to be very polite and listen, but also to be sort of firm about not wanting to take their survey. You know?
Right. But, yeah. But, I mean, it's true. You hurt people's feelings without knowing it. And yeah, I have sympathy for them.
Right. You know, because it's easy to just assume that the person who's calling is the company, and that's not the case.
No.
So anyway, right. Thank you for reading that. I loved that paragraph, and I loved that sense that I think we all have of, like, you know, imagining what we could do to become the people we want to become. And I think very frequently, you know, we think about it a lot more than we actually do it. So I really...
Oh, it's so much easier to think about it, yes.
I totally related to that.
Good. Yeah, we actually talked about cutting that story, my editor and me, but I wanted to keep it. So I'm glad that you like it. And I liked it too. So it was a lot of fun to write also.
Yeah. I mean, the people just seemed very, very real to me. And you know, it's not famous people. It's the unfamous. And I think that's important in a story collection that has famous people. You also have to have some not famous people.
Yeah. There's really, you know, one of the reviews that was just published, the reviewer focused on only the three stories that are about famous people, and I was really happy that he liked them, but I also thought, oh, there's 10 other stories in there that are not about famous people.
Right, yeah.
So it's just, you know, the title is the title that I wanted for the book, and it does, you know, set the tone to some extent, but it's, you know, these men weren't famous to begin with, so that to me is interesting. It's just, who were these people before they became famous?
Right. People are just people.
Yeah.
Even George Clooney is just a person.
Yes, I know. He is. He has to brush his teeth, and he has to go to the doctor and, you know,
right.
Wear shoes that fit.
But it must be weird to be George Clooney's doctor. How odd. You're listening to Write the Book and a new interview with Christine Sneed, author most recently of The Virginity of Famous Men, just out from Bloomsbury, USA. If you're enjoying the podcast, I would love it if you'd head on over to iTunes and rate it, or just pass along the show's information to some friends. Thanks and keep listening. I wonder if we can talk about a story called Five Rooms. This is a wonderful story. It's about a teenage girl who is helping a blind man. At the beginning, she's sort of just helping him through the details of his life, helping him with laundry and things like that. And then it goes on from there. But I wanted to just read a line in Five Rooms. She says at one point, he went blind 9 years ago when I was seven, but I didn't meet him until last year. And then it goes on. And just that line made me think about presenting the details of time in a story and leading a reader through so that they understand time and chronology. And I wondered if you play with time a lot as you write, and if we can just talk about that a little bit.
That's a question that does come up somewhat regularly with my students especially, and then even just other friends who are writers. We talk about how to handle time in a story or a novel. And I mean, fortunately, at this point, it's pretty instinctive. I just put in these signposts, you know, that make it clear if it's the next day or if I'm moving back in time. I'll say, you know, like a week earlier, or it's not, I mean, I don't have a big problem with it, knock on wood, but I do notice that I'm always thinking about it, especially when I have to go into, you know, a character's interiority, just how do I talk about who this person was, you know, when they were a child or mm-hmm. last week. So, I mean, and one thing too is you can do very obvious things. You can just break it into sections. You can number the sections. You can also use words to delineate different parts of the story. So instead of using a number, just use a word mm-hmm. as a header. but I think, I mean, yeah, I do find that I don't want to keep adding. And then later, meanwhile, the next day, you do want it to seem organic and seamless. But I think one thing is just not to leap around too much in time, unless it is a longer work. I think with a short story, especially, you have to be pretty tight with the way that you're handling the narrative arc. Mm-hmm. And I mean, of course, the one model that is often taught in first workshops or early beginning workshops is the 24-hour period or the one-day scenario.
Right.
So that students don't try to write like an entire life in 20 pages, which, you know, they can try it, but it might not work. So I think, you know, if you're worried about time, it's better to set it over a shorter period if that's what you feel more comfortable with.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, I do make use of different gimmicks, like numbering sections and using headers sometimes.
And the other thing that was so great in Five Rooms, just as a great example of establishing story, right away, like really on the first and second page, you set down important points that will be expanded on later. The story begins, two questions you don't ask a blind person. Aren't black and white movies boring? Is that cop car following me? So, you know, first of all, we get a lot of her personality in that sentence, but also we know it's going to be about a blind person. And then the second paragraph starts, what I don't like about making a mistake is that no one gives you the chance to explain yourself. So, you know, that's another thing that tells us about her, but also tells us something about what's going to happen in the story or what the story is going to sort of involve. And then another one is, Wednesdays we go grocery shopping. Thursdays I do his laundry so that I'll learn to be a good person. And to me, this one was so good because it establishes what she's doing, but also the words are clearly somebody else's, like her mom has told her yes. that she has to learn to be a good person. Anyway, all of that's pretty much on the first page. It's not a short story. It's probably 20 pages long or so, but you give us a lot right away to hold on to. And I wondered if you can just talk about establishing story and engaging a reader in what's going to be expanded on.
Well, thank you. I actually didn't notice all that until you read it out loud. You know, I realized that I try to cram a lot into every paragraph, no matter if it's a story or a novel, but especially with a story, I'm really thinking about compression. And so, and this is something that other writers have said, and I know it was Toni Morrison who said, or maybe it was Alice Walker, I'm just trying to look closely at something and, you know, really see it.
Right.
And so, you know, with good writing, and Joanna Rakoff has said this too. I read a review with her, an article with her, and she just said that she's, you know, writing with precision is the single most important thing that a writer can do. And I agree with that wholeheartedly. So I really try to be very precise and how, you know, to me, of course, when you're writing, and you too, with your writing, you just see stuff because you're writing it and you can see it in your head, but mm-hmm. you don't know what readers are going to see. And so when someone says, oh, I really could have pictured that person or I could see the scene, and I'm just so glad because you just don't know. So I really do try to be very specific. And,
yeah.
And also having been a poetry grad student, I really learned, I guess, to think about imagery and to think about sensory detail. So that has helped me as a fiction writer, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Now, the blind man in Five Rooms is Mr. Rasmussen. And I wondered if you ever played around with making him the narrator or not, and how you go about finding your narrators, or do you ever kind of flip around what's going on in a situation that you find interesting, but maybe you haven't figured out who's in charge.
You know, the voice for Five Rooms arrived at, you know, right away, and I didn't actually ever think of having it be anyone else's point of view.
Right.
But I like the idea of maybe having it be Mr. Rasmussen's. It wasn't, you know, it's only with longer fiction. Like with a novel, I've definitely worked with, I do move around with point of view. I might change something from first to third, or I might add a point of view character to try to bring something else into the book.
Right.
But with stories, I usually know at the beginning, or I don't know, but I just sort of grope my way through and feel like, okay, this is the right narrator, and I just hope it'll work. I didn't think about having him be the narrator. It was very much her as a 16-year-old sort of understanding that adults have a different sort of sorrow than a teenager does.
Right. I think one thing that makes it interesting the way you wrote it is that she doesn't necessarily understand him very well, whereas he's been a teacher and he's a lot older and more mature, and so he's probably going to have more empathy for her than she has for him.
Yeah.
Until she's moved through the story, you know, with him. So I like her as a narrator. I was just curious if you had played around with it.
No, that's a good idea. That's a good question. I'm glad that you thought she worked too.
She did. Yeah.
Ultimately. Yeah.
Now, you have a story in here called Roger Weber Would Like to Stay. And it's a ghost. There's a ghost in the story, a very prominent ghost. And actually there's a ghost in the novel I'm working on right now, and I worry that it's a risky thing to do. Probably less risky in a story, but I wondered if we could talk about that. What you think about that? Is that risky? And also, you know, the ghost in this story is, he's a character, and he's a great character, and it's not like he's, you know, coming around the corner and saying boo or anything, so.
You know, I do think it is a risk, but I also just knew that I would use him in a way that wouldn't maybe be what people expected, or at least I hoped not.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's a ghost, but he could be a real person.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he could just be another guy who's trying to get her attention, and he's not dead. So, you know, that sort of ghostly gimmicky thing, like you said, the ghost that yells boo.
Yeah.
I've never written a ghost story before, except maybe when I was a kid and I was first trying to write. I don't remember, but I like ghosts, and I think, I mean, not literally, but you know what I mean. I think having a ghost in the story can be a lot of fun. And,
yeah.
I think I was, because I don't like scary movies, I'm just too susceptible to them. I freak out, so I never go to scary movies, and I don't like the traditional ghost, you know, like the scary, I just am more interested in a ghost as sort of a lost soul, you know, and still being very human, but not having a body in the traditional sense. So, mm-hmm. And I think too, like if you're using a ghost for comic, purposes, like he's kind of a comic, you know, element in the story, that could be something that would be fun, you know, but I don't know what you're doing with your novel. I just think I think for me, it's important that the ghost seem like a human.
Yeah.
At least it was when I was writing the story.
And that's a really good point about the comedy of the story. I think that comedy in that particular story, you know, because your collection can go in sort of, I don't know, like a wave as far as the tone of each piece. And this one definitely kind of made me smile and rose me up, you know, and some of the stories are really much more serious and a little bit harder. So I liked that this story had a comic aspect to it.
Yeah, it was fun. I like writing stories. If I can pull it off, I really like writing humor. It's but it has to be natural. I can't just, you know, like force it in there. I don't think it has to just sort of happen.
Yeah. Now, in the story, Roger Weber Would Like to Stay, you include a number of literary and cultural references. And as I read them, I was thinking, you know, a reader may or may not know them all, like Rosebuds and Mrs. Muir and that partial Sartre line, which is the one that translates to Hell is Other or Hell is Other People, I think it's mostly usually translated as. So I wondered if you can talk about doing that, and also about including foreign words within an English narrative for American readers or for, you know, English-speaking readers?
Well, I can say just from having written a novel that was set mostly in Paris and having quite a bit of French in there, that Paris, he said, that my editor and I talked about that a lot. And I ended up translating almost everything that wasn't just kind of a common French word or expression. So yes. I think it can be dangerous, but I always try to assume that my reader will either look it up or will know it. Because, you know, there's lots of writers who I've read who do not translate foreign words, and it's just kind of left to us to look them up ourselves. And so I feel like we have to do that, and it's a kind of a moral imperative. It's just like as our ongoing education, you know, we should continue to teach ourselves even when we're not in school anymore. But I do think it can interrupt the story sometimes. So, and then the same thing with cultural references. I worry occasionally, especially if they're too contemporary, that that's maybe the litmus test. How recent is this? Like Mrs. Muir, The Ghost of Mrs. Muir, that's an old movie, so it's already part of the kind of, you know, cultural zeitgeist, I guess. So I didn't worry about it being too arcane. And yeah, some readers will not know it, but I just thought, well, they can look it up and it's a real movie and they could watch it if they want to. So I learn a lot from reading fiction that has references to things that I wasn't familiar with previously.
Right. And I tossed it off quickly, but The Rosebuds is a Shakespeare reference, which I think most people would also get that one.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so, yes.
I have to be honest, I looked up the Sartre.
The French, the thing is, I think now, you know, languages, like most people take Spanish, or if you took French, it was a long time ago, and you just don't, I don't know much German at all, so German appears a lot in books, and I'm always like, I don't know that word, and then the writer thinks that you do know it, but I don't, so, yeah, it is a risk, but I think it's a good thing to look it up. Especially now with the app, you can get Google Translate on your phone. So it only takes
easy.
Like a second. So,
that's true.
Yeah.
Now, in that same story, your ghost says at different points, so like on one page, your ghost says Sartre was right. He's referring to Hella's other people. And then later, the same character says the poets were right. And it just made me think about refrain and its possible value in prose. And I know you were trained in poetry, and there's a lot of refrain in poetry. But do you have any thoughts about refrain in prose?
You know, I really do not consciously try to include any refrain. And if it happens, it's a sort of fortuitous parody, maybe, P-A-R-I-T-Y. I just hope that instead of P-A-R-O-D-Y, maybe it does sound like I'm parodying someone, but I hope it. I think things do, like, I feel like it's kind of a way for me to know if something's working, if later when I read through a draft, I see, oh, this is like a close parenthesis. You know, I realize that this refers to something I wrote earlier in the story that I might have forgotten about, but it was somehow in my subconscious. And so there is the pairing, you know, that happens, but it's really not usually conscious.
Right.
The only thing that I really consciously try to do in a story is by the end, there has to be some sort of a crisis or an epiphany. Nothing really, I mean, that's one thing that I think people who've read my work, they sometimes complain, well, not a lot happens. And I'm always like, a lot has happened. How can you say that? You know, because think most of the time we don't experience our lives as a series of cataclysms. Thank God. I mean, how exhausting would that be? And so we experience them as a collection of moments that are basically all survivable, but some of them are harder than others. And you learn things about your own character that are, you know, potentially difficult to ingest and live with. But the same thing, I mean, that's what I really think about in fiction all the time is, well, what about this character is a bad, like, not a nice thing? And what is he or she going to do with that knowledge?
Right.
And because, you know, if you're always happy and you're always having everything happen that you want to happen, then you're not really, I mean, you're not fully experiencing life, I think, the way that everyone else basically experiences it, because we don't always get what we want. And so, you know, what happens when we don't? So by the end of the story, there has to be some sort of conflict that occurs, whether it's a small one or not. It's just, there has to be a moment where someone realizes something that he didn't or she didn't realize before.
Yeah. I also think, as a reader, when I find a refrain that I recognize from earlier in the story, it just makes me feel like I I don't know. It makes me feel good. I don't know why. It's like anytime we recognize something, it gives us a sense of comfort almost.
Yeah, I was reading an article recently that was kind of an omnibus review of a number of films that was in the May 2016 Harper's, and the writer was talking about Carol and Hail Caesar and a few mm-hmm. other movies, and he was finding all these similarities, and I was thinking, I've seen all those movies, and wow, I didn't notice all that before. Wow, this guy really paid attention, you know? So I thought it was, for him as a writer and also as a critic, it must have been an aha moment where he realized that, wow, this theme is carrying over, and this is how the writer is working with it. And it's very satisfying. And
yeah, particularly if it's subtle. I mean, it's not like with Casey and the Sunshine Band, and every song is exactly the same. I think subtlety is
better. Yes. No, that's true. That's ideal. Yeah. And it's good because I might notice it more in other people's work than my own. So if someone sees it in mine, I'm glad it's there.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about the title story, The Virginity of Famous Men, and the fact that you returned to a character from a previous book, which was Little Known Facts, which is actually a book I haven't read, but I did read about the fact that you have returned to a character here. Mm-hmm. Had you just not mm-hmm. finished with him, or do you do this very often? Do you play around with bringing characters back in a future piece?
I don't, usually, at all. But the reason why I ended up writing about Ren and Will Ivins again, and The Virginity of Famous Men is because several people had asked me, well, what's going to happen now? And, are you writing a sequel? And I thought, well, no, I'm not, actually, and the book's over. But just as the title itself, I thought, well, Ren Ivins would be the perfect character for that story. So
yeah.
I just wanted to, and in the novel, Will, his son, who's in Paris in the story, and it's also in the novel, near the end of the book, he goes to Paris. He is finally kind of hitting his stride. So I just wanted to show him in a better place, but still have, mixed feelings about his relationship with his father.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And then the other thing about this story, The Virginity of Famous Men, is you return to Paris. And I wondered if this is your favorite setting, maybe.
I wrote, Paris, he said, because my favorite chapter in Little Known Facts was set in Paris. And mm-hmm. that was the chapter with Will Ivins near the end of the book. And so okay. I thought, well, I really enjoyed writing that chapter a lot. And I studied in France and I speak French and I'm interested in French culture. And so maybe I should try to write a novel set in Paris. And that was why I ended up working on that book. And I do, I'm working on a short story now that is about a woman, an American woman and a Parisian man. And so, mm-hmm. and it's set kind of over a period of 20 years or so. Okay. So I think it's just an interesting topic, but I don't know if it's my favorite setting. It's just a lot of fun to write about. Actually, I think LA is maybe my favorite setting. I really like writing about Hollywood.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
that might change, but it's at this point, I really do enjoy writing about California, especially Southern California.
Yeah, okay. Now, you had a couple great reviews, one in Booklist that compares you to Anne Beatty, Amy Hempel, and Edith Perlman. That was awesome. You had a nice review in the Bookseller, the UK review, and then other ones too. So anyway, how much do you pay attention to reviews? And also a friend of mine just got a not so great review and it's been just absolutely hard. So I wonder, do you have,
I pay too much attention to them. They really crush me too. When I've had bad reviews, it's awful. I mean, I could see why a lot of writers, or at least some writers, try not to read reviews. I think that's kind of a luxury, though. I mean, if you're not selling books, then you're probably going to be reading reviews because you want to know why your books aren't selling. And that's one reason. I mean, there's obviously many reasons why books sell or don't sell. But I definitely look at my reviews. I try to skim some of them if I feel like they're painful. So, I'll try not to. But, pre-publication reviews, there's obviously varying opinions about how important they are. But they do matter, because especially if you're not a well-known writer, the only introduction a lot of people will have to you is through a pre-publication review. So it does matter. And to some extent, there are plenty of books, though, that you could say, oh, they got horrible reviews and the man ended up becoming a bestseller for one reason or another.
I've heard that a bad review in the New York Times will still help your book sell better than no review in the New York Times.
Oh, I think so, yes.
Yeah.
I really do. I mean, just because there's 1.7 million people, apparently, who read the Sunday Book Review.
Yeah.
And then the daily reviews, I think you have even more exposure.
Yeah.
So if you get a daily review instead of a Sunday Book Review, you have even more people, whether it's good or bad, I think. It definitely, and people also feel sympathy sometimes when a writer gets a really bad review. They're maybe even wanting to see the book. They want to decide for themselves if it's not good.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, great. I was just going to ask you, are you reading anything these days that you might recommend to listeners?
Yes, I've been reading Rachel Cusk. I'm reading her an earlier novel by her, The Country Life, which is really a lot of fun.
Okay.
And then I have a friend who has a story collection coming out in October called The Jungle Around Us. Her name is Anne Reyes. And it's a Flannery O'Connor winner from last year.
So oh, okay.
I just read that recently, and I like that a lot.
Oh, great.
And,
okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. And then what are you writing these days, Christine?
I just was working on a revision of a new novel. I just sent it off to my agent yesterday, actually. So
that's exciting.
I don't want to say anything more about it, just because I feel like it's so new, and I don't know what she'll say. So we'll see. But it's set in Wisconsin, actually.
Okay.
Which is where I'm from originally.
Oh wow, that's great. Okay, I won't make you say any more about it. And then I thought my last question, since this is about this is a story collection, and actually it's funny, the advanced reading copy that I have doesn't say, I don't think, in the beginning where these stories appeared earlier, but I wondered if you could just sort of give advice for listeners as far as placing stories in journals and magazines.
One thing I would say is you have to be persistent. Some of these stories, this is my first book, Portraits of a Few of the People I've Made Cry, had 10 stories in it, and 7 of them were published, and the other 3 never made it into a lit journal.
Okay.
And so one of them, which ended up being a story that people mention often when, not like people were talking about it a lot, but just sometimes people would say, oh, I really love that story. And I said, oh, that's one of the stories I had so much trouble, I never was able to place it.
That's interesting.
So I think you have to just trust your instincts, but with submissions to journals, don't carpet bomb. I wouldn't send the story to 30 places at the same time, but I do recommend sending like 6 or 7 different submissions of one story at a time, and but have some familiarity with the journal. Even if you're not buying it, you should probably read the content that they have online free for readers, just
right.
So you know. Because some journals will publish quirky stuff if you're writing satire, and other journals never publish stuff like that. So you should have some sense of the ethos for the editors at the publication. And then just if there's a story collection that you love by someone, look at the places where he or she published those stories. And if you have ones that are anything like it, or thematically or subject wise, I would try those editors.
So would you mention in the letter that you read, Christine Sneed's story, and that you feel that, that the editor will like your work because it's maybe a little bit like hers?
Oh, I think that's a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I do, because it shows familiarity with the contents of a past issue, and most editors, and I've guest edited lit journals a little bit here and there. And most editors assume that most of the people submitting haven't picked up a copy. So it's really a good thing to try to distinguish yourself. But that said, they really only care about the work.
Mm-hmm.
So if the story's good, that's the most important thing, but it helps to, because it might get you past the first initial screener if you say that, I like your journal a lot, and the story that I recently read reminded me of something that I've been writing, and, that could be helpful.
Okay. All right. Well, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for that advice for listeners. And thank you for talking to me today. I just want to mention again, the name of the book is The Virginity of Famous Men, story collection by Christine Sneed, published by Bloomsbury. Thank you so much, Christine.
Thank you, Shayla. I really enjoyed our talk.
That, again, was a conversation with Christine Sneed. If you'd like to read more about her work, you can visit her website at christinesneed.com. This week's Write the Book prompt comes from our generous guest, Christine Sneed. Choose one of the following characters and write 10 interview questions for him or her. Someone who works on the housekeeping staff in a Las Vegas hotel. Someone who wants a famous face. Someone who owns 30 pairs of blue jeans. Someone who runs a tow truck. Now answer those 10 questions in the voice of the character. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And as I said earlier, if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. Have a great week.